Okay, ready? Everybody settle and action. Pam Grier is
Jackie Brown.
Pam Grier is
Jackie Brown.
Pamela Grier is
Jackie Brown.
Here we go.
If you have the chance to walk off with $500,000, would you take it?
Yeah.
I never met a girl who makes me feel the way that you do.
You're all right.
Whenever I'm asked who makes my
feet. Who's that?
That's Bowman. Who's Bowman? My employee I had to let go.
Look out, baby.
When'd you get out of jail?
4 days ago.
For what?
Bank robbery.
Well, I'm impressed. Ever been tempted?
AK-47. When you absolutely, positively got to kill every mother in the room. Except no substitutes.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and my semi-regular co-host, David Ace Gutierrez, is back. Hi, David.
Hey, man. Ready to launder some money?
I am totally ready to launder some money. We're here to talk about Jackie Brown, Quentin Tarantino's 1997. I'm going to call it his masterpiece. I think Pulp Fiction's a masterpiece.
It is the best one.
But this is the best one. We will get to that momentarily about the critical consensus on this movie. I love the hell out of this movie. This is like my top 10 favorite movies of all time. Now, did you see this in the theater?
I did. I did. It hit three of my like the right buttons for me. Elmore Leonard, Pam Grier,
okay,
which is a huge button to hit for me,
sure.
and Tarantino. So yeah, I was so excited when I heard about this. When I heard, and you know, I'm a big Michael Keaton fan
because
of Batman. And so when I heard he was going to be in it, I was even more excited.
Oh, I mean, this movie's cast is fantastic. It's Pam Grier, Robert Forster, Robert De Niro, Michael Keaton, Samuel L. Jackson, and Bridget Fonda. And one of the things I love about this movie is that you would imagine that even Quentin Tarantino, with all of his, juice in the business, as they say, like he could not have gotten a movie made starring Pam Grier and Robert Forster, because in 1997, like, nobody really cared about them as box office draws. So he surrounds them with names: Samuel L. Jackson and De Niro and Keaton and Bridget Fonda, who was like, Bridget Fonda was still kind of a movie star at that point. She was kind of just about to retire, but she was still a thing. So I love that he surrounds his main two characters with these other bigger names, which of course helps sell it. But this is really Grier and Forster's movie. I mean, to anybody who hasn't seen it yet, I love the IMDb description of this movie. A middle-aged woman finds herself in the middle of a huge conflict that will either make her a prophet or cost her her life.
And it's bare bones.
That is one of the greatest non-descriptions really ever in history. A thing happens, followed by other events that conclude. Like, okay, thank you. That's great. Yeah, you mentioned Elmore Leonard. This is based on, what, Rum Punch, right?
Rum Punch.
Okay, have you read Rum Punch? I've never read
any
of his books.
I have.
Okay.
The movie does differ slightly. The ending's a little different.
And Jackie Brown is a white woman, right, in Rum Punch?
Yeah, okay. Blonde, actually.
Blonde white woman, okay, right.
But I can't think of anybody better to play anything than Pam Grier, to be honest.
No, I mean, she's fantastic. Apparently, he had briefly toyed with putting her in Pulp Fiction, and she was going to play the Rosanna Arquette part, which is like, that's hysterical to think of Pam Grier and Eric Stoltz as a couple.
And she's got like 2 years on him.
Yeah, that too. That would have been a little odd. And I guess Tarantino was like, you know, nobody would buy that Pam Grier is sort of the doormat wife of Eric Stoltz. That's just not plausible. So he said to her, "I'm going to work with you someday. And she kind of was like, yeah, I've heard that before. But he really meant it. And he gave her like the role of a lifetime. I mean, this Jackie Brown, obviously, It's a gloss on her classic blaxploitation movies of the 70s. I mean, the font that he uses for Jackie Brown in the opening sequence is right out of is Foxy Brown. It's the same exact font.
Across 110th Street.
And you've got 110th,
it's not a blaxploitation song, but it evokes that whole, you know, the whole opening sequence of her just in, you know, on that escalator. It just, you know, it is 70s.
Oh, it's even got the little copyright notice down at the bottom of the screen when it comes out. Yeah, I mean, I saw this movie. Look, when I saw all, I've seen all of Tarantino's movies in the theater, I believe. Actually, Inglourious Basterds is the only one I've missed. But I saw Pulp Fiction at the time, and I thought it was a masterpiece. I still think it is. I think it deserves all of the credit that it gets. And I will admit that when I went in to see Jackie Brown in 1997, I was a little underwhelmed. You know, I liked it, but I was like...
Seriously?
Yeah, I was. I was like, okay, that was good, but it wasn't what I thought I was going to get. And I was, you know, look, I was 25 when Jackie Brown came out, and it was harder for me to relate to the story of these middle-aged people at sort of a crux in their lives. And so... Look, I liked it. I definitely liked it. But
then you became a flight attendant who started laundering money through Jamaica.
I did start carrying cocaine for Samuel Jackson. So that I really felt like, wow, this is really my life. No, it was I liked it and I sort of forgot about it. And then years later, I started seeing these internet pieces about Jackie Brown is Quentin Tarantino's true masterpiece. And I was like, oh yeah, sure. Because I dismissed those pieces because I've read 1,000 things about, you know, The Trial is Orson Welles' best film, or Chimes at Midnight is Orson Welles' best film. No, it isn't. It's Citizen Kane. Stop it. You know, I feel like there's always that thing of like, I have to be the alternate take. And I sort of dismiss those Jackie Brown pieces as like, oh, that's just the obvious answer is Pulp Fiction, and nobody wants to say that, so they're picking something else. And then I rented Jackie Brown from a thing called a video store, and I was older by that point, and I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. I'm like, this movie's a masterpiece. And I went back and read some contemporary reviews. And one of the things that I saw that Roger Ebert wrote was, even though this movie is about almost 3 hours long, it's 2 hours and 34 minutes, he wishes it could have kept going. Like, he just wants to spend more time with these characters. And I'm totally on board with that. Like, even though this movie is that long, and it's languidly paced, it's not a movie that... It's deliberate. I could watch a 5-hour cut of Jackie Brown if one existed. I want to spend more time with Max Cherry and Jackie and Ordell and all these people. Like, he just, and especially Michael Keaton's character, I love him.
You could spend more time with a few of these characters if you really wanted to.
Oh man, it is so beautifully well done. I mean, we got to talk about everybody. I mean, again, Pam Grier, she is perfect as Jackie Brown. I mean, the whole thing opening up where we find out that, you know, she works for Cabo Airlines, this little shit-ass airline where she makes $16,000 a year plus benefits. But it's like, you can, I don't know, like, you can sort of see how someone like her, who seems like this powerful woman, has just been sort of pushed around by life and is kind of hiding out because she just doesn't know how to sort of, like, life has passed her by. And you could say that in some ways about Pam Grier. Like, Pam Grier was a huge star in the 70s, and then Hollywood had no use for her at a certain point. And then when you see her in this movie, you're like, she's effing awesome. Why isn't she in more movies?
Let me say, like, huge star asterisk. You know what I mean? Like because of the time and because she was a black woman, there's only so far she would have been allowed to go, period. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
During that time. And because of, you know, she did Corman movie. It's not surprising that it took this long for people to realize how amazing she is because of the, you know, just the system, if you will.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if life was fair, she would she would have continued to be a big star.
If life was fair, she would have gotten an Academy Award for this role.
This movie was ignored at the Oscars. It only got a nomination for Robert Forster. Didn't even get like a Best Picture, which is ridiculous.
And he was supporting actor nomination, not even Best Actor.
I guess they consider Sam Jackson the lead male in this movie. I
mean, that's ridiculous.
No, he's pretty big part in it, though. I mean, yeah. I mean, the central relationship is those two. I mean, look, Robert Forster, him and Grier have such beautiful chemistry. That scene where he has to bail her out, where he goes to pick her up.
Yeah.
And there's just this hold on his face as she comes walking down, like this not a hallway, like she's outside, like he goes to pick her up and there's like that gate and you have to like drop your gun off there and whatever, and they just, Quentin Tarantino just holds on him as she approaches, and you know, like you can read it on his face, he has instantly fallen in love with Jackie Brown, like right in that moment. It is one of my, in a movie full of my favorite scenes, that is one of my all-time favorite scenes, because it's just, it's everything about acting, about like what Forster conveys. He is completely smitten with this woman, and he's not even spoken to her yet. It's fantastic.
To be fair, that would be any of us.
Well, that's true. But I mean, it's right. But Forster is able to pull that off. And again, that's another guy who, you know, fills the screen. Like, he absolutely crushes this part. I love him as Max Cherry. He seems kind of not soft. He's a bail bondsman and he has like a stun gun and all this stuff. But I mean, he seems kind of genial in a lot of ways. And then the scene where Sam Jackson playing Ordell Robbie goes to him and he talks about that he wants to bail Jackie Brown out after he has bailed out Beaumont, played by Chris Tucker, the motor mouth Chris Tucker.
That's my favorite Chris Tucker performance.
Oh, Tucker's great. It's great. I'm home and I'm high. And why aren't you home?
Because it's short and he's disposed of quickly. Yeah. I think that's why it's my favorite. Mm-hmm. But we should cover Friday one of these days.
Okay. I haven't seen that movie in a long time. But when Ordell talks to Max Cherry and he's talking about that how Jackie Brown is being railroaded, you know, right. And he's like, well, what do you mean? She did, you know, Jackie's falsely accused. And he says, falsely accused? He says she didn't have drugs and money in her bag. And he goes, hey, if that was her, not to sell, if she had drugs, that was her own shit to get high with. And there's that great pause, and Max Cherry just says, is white guilt supposed to make me think, must make me forget that I'm running a business? I was like, you're right in that moment, you're like, he sees through Sam Jackson's bullshit.
I mean, he's one of these guys from the Mitchum School to me, whose face, just like those lines in the face, do 85% of all the performance. You're not even sure if he's moving any features or anything, mm-hmm. but there's just a weariness with every pause or everything he says. It just comes with like, I'm going through this again, kind of a thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Weathered. Yeah. He's seen it all. When he goes back to to Jackie's place and they talk about where they have the coffee, and at one point she's walking around and she's in a bathrobe because she just got a shower, and he's looking at her so admiringly, and she starts talking about they have this great conversation about what it is to get older, which is like you don't see that in movies. You know, like they make movies about super young people. And then make movies about really old people, like Cocoon, where it's like that's the kind of like
– who want to be super young people.
What did you say?
Who want to become super young people again.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But they never make movies about middle-aged people. And these are people like in the middle of their lives and they're facing down the choices they've made. And they realize that they don't have as many options open to them as they used to. And they're worried about that. And that whole scene – is the crux of like this whole thing, because Jackie has this whole plot to scam Ordell and get them to steal his money from him.
She's going to play everyone against each other.
Right. And he says, you know, basically, you know, you're risking your life. And she's like, I make $16,500 a year. I have benefits that aren't worth shit. I have no ability to start over anywhere else. And she's like, that shit is way more scary to me than anything Ordell could do. And I'm like, that's the crux of it. Like, this is a woman who's in her 50s.
It's a real fear. It's real fear.
Yeah.
You know, it's some everyday fear.
Yeah. It's like, I could get shot by Ordell, but that ain't that bad compared to, like, having to work until I die. But in that scene, though, I want to talk about that scene with Forster where you're talking about where Forster says – where she's like, you know, it's harder getting older. And he says, I don't think I have a lot of sympathy for you in this arena. He says, other than an afro, I'm betting you look the same that you did when you were 29. And she's like, there's my ass. And he goes, bigger? And she says, yeah. And he goes, ain't nothing wrong with that. And it's like Robert Forster is able to make it sound like a sweet nothing that he just said, your ass is bigger, and that's great. It's such a sweet moment. And you're like, no, I don't know any other actor that could have pulled that line off.
Good. No, he's... And it's weird, like for him, there was just a lot of just little bit roles. You know, he was supposed to be – he was considered for Reservoir Dogs, mm-hmm, I should say. Mm-hmm. But then that part went to Lawrence Tierney.
Right.
which was a nightmare anyway. Tierney, not the easiest guy to with whom to work. But, you know, to Tarantino's credit, he puts him as – and he's, I couldn't think of anybody who could play Max Cherry. I know Stallone was I guess, a front runner. Sylvester Stallone was a front runner for Max Cherry. And based on his performance, I guess it would have been like a couple of years or – I forget what year Copland was out.
95. Actually, I think Stallone was in the running for Louis Gara, played by De Niro.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. You're right. Yes. Sorry. You're right. You're right. You're right. You're right.
We have to talk about De Niro, too. I mean, De Niro, for God's sakes, saying Robert De Niro was great in a movie is like, you know, wow, news at 11.
Well, it's harder to say these days.
It is harder to say, but he's great in this because I think it's hard for smart people to play dumb people. But he plays the dim-witted Louis Gara so well. There are moments where somebody, especially Ordell, is trying to talk to him, and he's like, Louis! And you just see that, like, this blank look on Louis Gara's face. Like, De Niro found a way to make Louis Gara just look like he's just zoned out. Like, he's just, you know, completely not paying attention to all the crazy crap that's going on. I love him. I love how scummy he looks in this movie, too. He's fantastic.
I love how everyone, except for Max Cherry, kind of really doesn't have much of, well, Jackie to some extent, but, like, everyone's just morally bankrupt. But everyone is super, yeah, there really aren't any dumb characters in the movie. Do you know what I mean? They make some dumb mistakes, but nobody's stupid, and I really appreciate that. Everyone, especially, you know, especially Ordell is probably this one of the smartest characters in the movie, if not the. He gets a little tripped up in his ego, which you know ultimately of you know proves his undoing. But everyone's so goddamn smart and smarmy, like Ray Nicolette. Played by Michael Keaton, just kind of a scummy guy. Like he's, you know, he's the Law and Order guy. He's the badge, but he's kind of an asshole.
He loves being a cop, and Max Cherry even says that at one point. He goes, yeah. He just loves being a cop, and yeah, they really do. When they first him and his partner,
They do a number on Jackie.
When they first run into her in the parking lot, him and his partner, Mark Dargis, played by Michael Bowen, who's been in other Tarantino movies, and they really do push her around. And I hate the way that like. Dargis says, you know, what do you make, $13,000 a year? And she's like, I make $16,000 plus benefits. And he's like, you've been in the service industry, you know, 19 years and you make $16,000 a year? You really set the world on fire, huh, Jackie? Like, he's just being such a dick to her.
Yeah.
And
I want to punch him.
Yeah, and the way they push her around. And, like, you do feel bad for her. I mean, I don't think Ray Nicolette's that as bad as that. I mean, but he is, you know, he looks at these people like, hey, I got to bust these people. And, of course, this movie is in the same universe as Out of Sight because Keaton plays Ray Nicolette in Out of Sight. And that's, of course, based on another Elmore Leonard book, which I thought that was a fun cameo. I remember when he shows up to be the boyfriend of Jennifer Lopez. I was like, oh, it's all one big cinematic universe.
You know, it's interesting. Well, in that, they shed a little more light on Nicolette's character because he's married.
Right.
He's supposed to be kind of – I think he's not even separated yet, but he's talking about it with his wife or something all the while caring – kind of having a relationship with Karen Sisko.
I think they even have a line in there where she's like – you know, where she's talking to her dad, Dennis Farina. She's like, is he married? He's like, no, they're separated. But are they divorced? No, they're separate. Dad, it's complicated. And the dad's like, it's not complicated. You know, it's like he's divorced or he's not. Yeah. But anyway.
That's why I think he's scummier.
Yeah, we'll talk about that when we do Out of Sight. But, anyway.
That's my favorite.
De Niro adaptation. De Niro was great. That scene with him and Bridget Fonda where they're making small talk about her trip to Japan. And then she just said, and, you know, pardon my language, where she's like, you want to fuck? And he's just like, yeah, and then the 3 minutes later card comes up, and then when the shot of De Niro having sex with Bridget Fonda is so hideous because they look like dogs, first of all, and then and then he says,
"There's a reason."
He says,
it's called what it is.
"He says they." He goes, "That hit the spot," which just makes my skin crawl. It's so hideous.
Well, he's a lifelong felon. You know what
I
mean?
Like he's God. Oh.
He's in and out of prisons. He's I kind of feel for Ordell at times because these are the people with whom he chooses to surround himself, and this is probably the best of the bunch for him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's, you know, not to cross-pollinate with your other podcast, but, you know, kind of like Luthor with Otis and Miss Tessmacher.
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a great comparison. I never really even thought about that. But you're right. They line up pretty well.
This guy's brilliant. She's a little – she's, I guess, more savvy. And then he's just dumb as a bag of rocks – a bag of hammers, I mean. And the smart guy can't do any better. He can't assemble anything better than this. Mm-hmm. And everybody he works with is a fool. So, you never saw the.
I mean, now that you say it, it seems obvious, but I never really made those direct comparisons. But you're right. It's like, yeah, Lewis is Otis, and Miss Tessmacher is Melanie. I mean, it really fits. Well, I mean, boy, Bridget Fonda. I'm not like big on like the surfer girl. Like that look is not like a thing that I'm particularly like that gets me going. But she's luminous in this movie. I mean,
she's luminous in every movie.
She looks well. It's true. She looks really sexy. I mean, you know, this is a Quentin Tarantino movie because the first shot we get of Bridget Fonda is of her feet, and so yeah. We know right there. But I
heard he has a foot thing. I don't know. I haven't tracked that in every movie that he's done.
Figure that one out. But like, I love her character because you really are like dying to find out like what is her deal. Why? What is about her and her self-image that she feels the need to associate both, like, sexually with Ordell and Lewis? Like, why is she attracted to these scummy guys? Like, what? I mean, we know that she just wants to sit around and get high. So I guess, like, Ordell is willing to fund that life, and that's good enough for her. Because yeah. She just talks about all she does is watch movies and sit around and get high. Although, of course, she does try and steal the money. She shows some initiative there, which ends up getting her in a bad way. Well, by the way, anybody who's listening, if you haven't seen this movie, we're going to spoil some parts of it. So if you haven't seen it yet, like, go see it. It's on Netflix. You can watch it right now. But just in case.
Or you should just own it.
You should own it. You should own it as well, yeah. But I mean, she's great as a movie. And it's such a shame that she basically packed it in not too long after this. Like, she just retired.
I think she was in, Kiss of the Dragon or something, and then that was it?
I'm going to forget the name of that. What, Kiss of the Dragon? What was that? I forget which movie.
Oh, wait, no. It was a Jet Li movie.
Okay.
Where he plays, I think he's a sailor.
It's called Kiss of the Dragon. I've never even really heard of that movie. But
well, no, but there's one with Aaliyah, and that's Romeo Must Die. Okay, yeah, so, yeah. Okay. Kiss of the Dragon.
Okay, yeah, because the
– what?
She has not been in a movie since 2002.
That's amazing.
Yeah. She's just disappeared. It's amazing. I mean, she's married to – what's his name?
Eric Stoltz.
No,
right?
No.
Oh,
no.
Danny Elfman.
Danny Elfman, yeah. So she's got – they've got money. I mean, she's got Fonda money, and he's got, you know, his soundtrack money. So, I mean, but I'm fascinated. Like, what happened? Like, why did she pack it in? She's really great. I think she's really funny in this movie. That scene of her – in the parking lot where she starts poking at Lewis. It's like you want to reach into the screen and be like, what are you doing? Like, you're going the way where she's like, hey, Lewis, is it this way, Lewis? And he's getting madder and madder. And he's like, don't say another fucking word. And then she says it and she gets it. I mean, the way Tarantino rubs her out in this movie is amazing. I mean, it's like she's one of the primary characters. And then he warns her, don't talk anymore, and she violates that, and she just falls out of frame when Lewis shoots her, and that's it. Like, we never see her again. It's I remember in the theater seeing people like jumped out of their skin when that came up because you're just not expecting to see one of the main characters just gunned down like that.
Well, get used to that in this movie. the rum punch goes a little bit more into her psychology and why she's the way she is.
Okay.
And same with did you read or have you read? Did you didn't read Rum Punch, right?
No, I've never read any Elmore Leonard book.
What?
No, sorry.
Oh my God!
Not on purpose.
Did you see Life of Crime though?
What's that?
There's a movie called The Switch that he wrote that has Ordell, Melanie, and Lewis.
Really?
Yeah. Do you want to talk about that now or?
Oh well, we'll talk about that later. We'll talk about that. That's fascinating. I didn't know that. I mean, I know there are other books with these characters, so I guess, but I didn't know that they're. I mean, obviously, it's all different actors, right?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Because okay. It's set in like 1984.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. All right. But I mean, I love that. That's unspoken. Is that like you really try to parse out like why would Melanie be with these guys? Like, what is it? What's broken in her?
A girl like that is always with these guys. You know what I mean? It's so. You see it. You see it.
I do
in your travels.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
What do you think about? you living in California, what do you think of this movie's very specific placing of you know, hotels and stuff. Like,
where that mall is just like 5 miles from here. Well, it's a new. It's called Mayfair now. Mayfield, okay. But it used to be Fox Hills.
What do you think that's the point of that is? Because, I mean, Tarantino is giving us landmarks that don't mean anything to anybody who doesn't live in that area.
Well, it's the only place he's lived, right? Mm-hmm. It's a you know, at the time, it's been gentrified, but at the time, it was a pretty black neighborhood. And he's got a very, you know, it's no secret. He zeroes in on, quote unquote, black culture quite a bit.
Right.
So that's his sweet spot. So it's very genuine in that sense. You know what I mean? It's if you were going to set an Italian crime drama in New Jersey, you know, where would you set? No, I'm serious. You know what I mean, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
This is where you would find a Jackie Brown. This is where, you know, that there are bail bondsmen all over the place.
Right.
In West LA, in Culver City, just around, you know, the surrounding areas of Inglewood, that anywhere there's, you know, because there are courthouses nearby too. So it just makes sense that you would have all these bail bondsmen.
I love that we get to learn so much about, like, bail bonding, like what it is. I mean, I love that Max Cherry goes through all that. I got to get a court of receivership. I got to do that. We learn all this stuff. He's just like this very pragmatic guy. I mean, Tarantino's movies are getting longer and longer, I think, and that might be an indication that he doesn't have his Sally Menke, his former editor, doing his movies anymore. Maybe, you know.
And he's by himself. Like, you have to remember, all the movies that he came up with are either adaptations or were co-written. So now he's completely on his own after Jackie Brown, I think, right? He's no longer working with Roger Avery.
Right.
Outside of Death Proof, it's all him.
Right. I mean,
so
I
think that's why, I think.
I have liked all of his movies. There isn't any of his movies I haven't liked, but I do feel that some of them, Django and Inglourious Basterds, are like a little on the bloated side. And I don't think Jackie Brown is, and I don't think Pulp Fiction is. And I think that, I wonder, is that the influence of Sally Menke, who unfortunately passed away at a very young age? But I wonder, like, if because she kind of came up with him, she was maybe a little more willing to kind of, like, you know, press him a little about how to edit these films. And I have to think that people that have worked with him afterwards are probably coming to him as like, oh, he's the legendary Quentin Tarantino.
Right.
He's more willing to kind of just, you'll just, you know, I don't mean to besmirch his editors now. I'm sure they do. No, really. No, I'm not trying. Let me be very clear. I'm not at all saying anything bad about his current editors or besmirching their skills or anything like that. But I just have to wonder, it's kind of like, you know, the people that worked with Orson Welles in the beginning were more willing, I think, to give Orson, you know, a critical response because he wasn't Orson Welles at that point. Later on, like, I'm sure now people that work with Steven Spielberg are probably a little more willing, or Lucas. You heard about Lucas in the prequels. People were just like, yes,
oh, everyone's
sir.
Like clapping every decision.
Yeah. Well, this is brilliant. Yeah. So, but like Jackie Brown, and like I have said before, one of my favorite moments in Pulp Fiction is when Travolta and Uma Thurman are about to do the dance, and Tarantino lingers on Travolta taking off his shoes one at a time, walking over to the side of the dance floor and putting them down. Like, most films would edit that out because you'd be like, why are we paused watch all that? But he's deliberate. He wants you to kind of just go at his pace. And Jackie Brown has lots of that stuff. I love the interaction with Ordell and Max Cherry where he notices the picture on the wall of Tiny Lister, who plays Winston. And he's like, who's that big Mandingo looking at MFR on the wall? And he's like, that's Winston. He works here. And he's like, you too tight? Yeah. But you're his boss, right? Yeah. But it's your idea to take that picture, huh? And Max just moves on to that. And right there in that little interaction, you're like, okay, these two are playing this little game back and forth. And then the whole interaction with Ordell and Lewis Carr about the car. About hey, what am I supposed to do? And he's like, you didn't do nothing. Just press a little button. You do, and you get in. You know, I love all those little details. I love that Tarantino does all the stuff about the Delphonics. That everybody listens to the Delphonics. Like, I love that when, you know, Max and Ordell are driving back to Max's office where Max might get shot, and they have time to talk about the Delphonics. Where he's like, I didn't know you liked the Delphonics. Yeah, I do. They're pretty good. Like, I love all that detail.
But I love how that's all just subtext. I mean, they're all just the entire – anytime they're together, they're just feeling each other out mm-hmm. and the situation and trying to surmise what each other's next move is going to be and how that will then impact their moves. It's just well done. It's Samuel Jackson, I don't think – so he's kind of those weird actors that I think sometimes gets too much credit and not enough.
Okay.
If that makes sense. Like he can do a job like this, and it's just blow it's amazing. And then something like, do you ever see Long Kiss Goodnight?
Yes, great. I like that.
It's amazing in that. Like they added footage of him because he was so good. But then you'll see something like what was the one with Patrick Wilson and Rose Byrne, and he's their neighbor. He's like a cop.
I don't even know that one. Wow, he's done so many movies. I can't keep track. Yeah. Wow.
It's the one he did that came – second one he did in April of 2000.
Okay. You said Rose Byrne, so I'm interested, but I don't know what movie that
is. I think it's Rose Byrne. I know it's your Night Owl. Your what is he to you? Your Black Manta?
Oh, he's going to be Ocean Master. Yes, Patrick Ocean Wilson Master. Is going to be Ocean Master. Yeah. That's right.
Anyway, he plays their cop neighbor who they can't go against because he's like – he rules kind of a thing. Not a great role. He's not great in that. Or as Mace Windu. You know, you're like, ugh, what are you doing, Sam? I hope the check's good kind of a thing. But then you see him in this, and he's just amazing. He's electrifying. I mean, because, you know, my heart always goes with Pam Grier. But I can't even really have a favorite person in this movie because they're all so goddamn good.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all at that level. All of them. Every single one. From a small role. Bridget Fonda has a fairly small role. But like you said, she's incredible in it. Chris Tucker is really good in it, and I hate Chris Tucker, and it hurts. And I hate to say that. Probably, you know, it just everyone's so solid, and he's one of those guys that can. I mean, that's how Jackson's one of those actors who can just do something like this, and you forget. And one time, this is one of the few times I forget I'm watching Samuel Jackson, if that makes sense, where I'm watching Ordell.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he's wonderfully charming. Yeah, he really does sink into that role. He's got all those little ticks and stuff. I love. There's a line he has.
His look is great.
Oh, I love his look with the long hair and that little chin thing that he's got. He looks like some sort of weird wizard or something. It's
you have
really
that?
Weird. Yeah.
Are you throwing that out?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's taking a while, but I'm going to do it. I like when he's in the apartment or no, that house at the end, and it's kind of like a pigsty, and he's like talking to that girl who's all drugged out, and he says something like, "How can you stand this?" And he's like, "This is some repugnant shit," which is hysterical because he has literally that same line in Pulp Fiction when he's cleaning up the brains in the car. Oh. He says, "This is some repugnant shit," which I have to think is Tarantino on purpose is giving him the same line. But yeah, I mean, he's the character that sort of everybody pivots around because he's the one who is running all these drugs and he wants to just pack a bunch of money away and retire. He talks about use the rest of my life spending, and that's what he wants to do.
Which is what
Jackie wants to do. Oh, shoot. What was I going to say? There was something about Samuel L. Jackson. I'm forgetting now. I did want to ask you about this. As a Star Trek fan, as you are, did you notice the Star Trek actor in this movie?
Star Trek actor in this movie?
There's a Star Trek Next Generation actor in this movie.
No.
Okay. Denise Crosby is Jackie's public defender.
She's, oh, that's right.
Yeah, in the scene with Sid Haig as the judge. She's only
12 episodes.
That's
right, yeah.
Blame the
synaptic. Oh, that's right, that's right, yeah. That's right.
Yep, yeah, she has that's like right. those two lines as the...
I was happy to see her getting work.
Yeah, she's in there. But yeah, I love all the side characters awesome. They mention. I love the guy, Stassen, the junkyard dog lawyer they talk about. And when Sam Jackson says, he loves to fuck with the police. he's better than... he'll kick Johnny Cochran's ass. I love all that stuff. Like all these little side guys that we hear about. It's just...
Leonard. Elmore Leonard is like...
Oh, is that Elmore Leonard? Okay.
Everybody... God, you really need to – okay. You need to give him a chance. I mean,
I will read Rum Punch. I want to read it. I will get around to it, I promise.
At this time, there was a bit of a Leonard Renaissance – or Elmore Renaissance, right? Because Get Shorty had come out a couple years before, right. And that was really successful. So then you had Jackie Brown. You had Last Stand in Saber River. You had Touch with – I think Bridget Fonda is in that. and Skeet Ulrich. And then you had Out of Sight, and then that everything kind of cooled for a while. He just manages to give every villain or every criminal is kind of not, I wouldn't say sympathetic, but they're all likable in some way. And they are, and every world is layered. I'll put it in your terms again. he says condescendingly.
Yeah. Well, I'm just letting that go. It's fine.
I mean, you know, it's like everything's like Mos Eisley. Is that the cantina?
Oh my God. Did I just hear you ask that? What is the matter with you? Yes, right. That's the cantina. Oh my God.
Sorry. I just want to I want to bring in your new fans. you know how you look at that and it's just like this is a hive of scum and villainy. That's every Elmer Leonard novel. But everyone you just want to like hug and see more of. And these are terrible human beings for the most part. Like they do terrible things. Ordell is a horrible person. He just is, but you like watching him.
Yeah. He's magnetic. He's absolutely magnetic. Oh, Max Cherry though. Max Cherry's not a bad guy.
No, but he's also the most boring. If that makes sense. I mean, I love watching him, but there's not a lot going on.
He's a very straightforward character. I would agree with that. Everybody else is a little more conniving, but he's really pretty straightforward. When he realizes that he loves Jackie, he lets his affection known pretty quickly. Like he's not shy about it, which I like.
Well, in the novel, he's got problems with his ex-wife. There's a whole running storyline.
I'm glad Tarantino cut all that out. That's great. I'm just like Max by himself running the thing. When he calls and he leaves that message for Jackie on how to contact him, and he leaves like he has to leave his beeper number, and he's like,
that really dates.
Oh my God. And it goes on for like 10 minutes, and it's like dial 59, wait for the star, hit your name, and it goes on. And I'm like that when I hear that bit, I'm like that is totally it me. That was me, you know, trying to like romance girls of just being trying way too hard. I mean, oh, I'll call you later. Just trying to sound not nervous, but being completely nervous. Like when I hear that whole bit, I'm like, oh, Max, I'm totally Max Cherry.
How long have you been with Tracy?
15 years. I think by the time everybody hears this, it'll be like almost exactly 15 years.
Did you have a cell phone then?
Yes, right at the yes, I did. I did. So we missed the whole beeper.
I would love to hear an outgoing Rob Kelly message an early Rob Kelly message to Darling Tracy.
Oh, I don't even.
Just read some Aquaman. Nothing. I'd see how you're doing.
So well,
watch something. Watch some movies.
All right. I didn't do any of that with her because, well, that's a whole other story. But there were girls before there were girls before Tracy that I definitely did the whole okay, I'll talk to you later. Okay, it's cool. Yeah. So when I hear that message and the way it goes, and by the way, Quentin Tarantino is the voice of the voicemail.
Right.
When I hear that go on, I'm like, that is so totally my life. And it makes me appreciate that Max Cherry is like 57 years old and still goes through that. That makes you feel a little better.
Well, because, he hadn't dated in years. Mm-hmm. He in the novel anyway, you know, it had been a long – he was in one of those marriages that was just long since crumbling.
Right.
And nobody's really making a move to end it yet. But she clearly is actually in the novel. She is ending things.
Okay.
And so he's kind of clinging on to that, but kind of not really. And he's rusty. He's off the dating game entirely. So it's very fitting that he would be so, you know, all thumbs about it. And it's Pam Grier. So I couldn't leave a message for Pam Grier.
Yeah,
with any,
just the two of them.
Forget. She's so – God damn it.
Oh, man. She's so powerful. She's so charming. And again, him and – the two of them are just so great together. I wish they had done more movies together. I just think they have such a great rapport, and I love that. I mean, I like hearing Quentin Tarantino's dialogue. To me, it's like music. It's very fun to listen to. But I can also appreciate that in some of his other films, people are like, oh, it's all just sort of references and stuff. But he strips all that out in this movie. These are just very plain conversation. Again, we talked about this at the beginning of the show, of like there aren't many movies about people in middle age. You know, you tend to get the extremes, but this is people that they're facing their choices and they're a little scared that this might be all that there is. And that That's just, you don't see that in movies very much. You see gunplay in movies all the time, and you see people stealing money all the time. And this movie has all that. But at the heart of it, it's just these two people, these two battered people that manage to find each other. And they have this instant like, and I guess we can jump right to the ending. I mean, I love movies that have perfect final scenes. That's hard to do. But this, the final scene of them in Max's office, to me is note perfect, where she's got all the money, she's going to go to Spain and just basically disappear. And she says, you know, she offers to come with, you know, for him to come with her, and he won't do it. Now, why do you think he won't go? Because earlier in the film, he talks about that he doesn't want to be a bail bondsman anymore. 19 years of this shit, you know, so why do you think he doesn't go with Jackie? Because he doesn't trust her?
I think he knows what, I think it's twofold, and some of it's been colored by the novel, right? So influence my interpretation. Sure. But I think he just doesn't know what else he could do. I think it's a reality a lot of people face, right? Where if, for example, if you're in an abusive marriage or whatever, you don't know if there's anything else. Like sometimes you just don't know that hateful thing that's known might be better than the unknown. Or there's that, I've always felt Max is fearful of everything. He's fearful of change. You know, he's settled in. This is it. It's shit for him, but mm-hmm. This is it for him. It's never gonna, I don't think he's ever thought of tomorrow, really. And that's all shaped from the ex-wife thing. But I don't think he ever considered, he's ever really considered leaving outside of just griping about it. And I don't think, like, he's never made really any steps toward that, right? Could you trust Jackie? Like, how well does he really know her?
Right.
I think it's the first time he thought about her, not felt about her, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Like, everything he's done has been to save her. And now that, and or to help her out. And now that that's happened, I think he might sense it. I don't know what's left, or I don't even know what we have here. So maybe it's nothing, and so I'll stay.
Hmm. Okay. I never thought of it that way, really. I always assume, like,
I'm deep, Rob.
You are deep. That's why I have you on. I always figured that he was just so afraid of the change. It was such a huge, to give up everything that he's known, to live on the other, not on the other side of the world, but live in a very different place and, you know, live off this money that they've gotten from Ordell, that they stole from Ordell. It's just too big of a change for him. And I love their kiss. It's passionate, but it's passionate, but it's also got a warmth to it. And then when she leaves and we see him walk to the back room and he starts going out of focus, and we just see him fold his arms as he just sort of ponders what he's done. It's so beautiful, and it's like achingly sad, because you're just like, you know, but yet it's sort of perfect. You know, it's like it would be almost too easy for them to just hop a plane and take off together. She's going to go off and do something else. But I love that fun. And that's when he brings up Tarantino on the soundtrack, brings Across 110th Street back up, which I love. And I love that the song opens the movie and closes the movie. But I love just that shot of him with his arms folded from the back, where he's just pondering his life as she takes off. And then the final shots are just her in the car singing the song. It's just, again, I could watch it for another hour. You know, if they were like, hey, I have a 4-hour cut of Jackie Brown, I'd be like, yeah, I'm on board for this. It's just, I really enjoy these characters. And I liked, in my mind, you know, in my little headcanon, I'm like, oh, you know what? They got together later on. Like, Max decided, oh, to hell with this bail bond shit.
People forget that you could book a later flight.
Exactly. he hands the business over to Winston, you know, because I love the relationship him and Winston have is great. They have like a genuine little friendship, even though they only have like I think Tiny Lister only gets like 3 lines of dialogue. I love their warmth together, you know, where he talks about he tells Max at one point, he's like, you know, be careful, you know, like he feels real warmth for his boss and his friend. I love that whole bit. Tiny Lister gets that whole thing about, you know, give me his home number. No, man, I give you his beeper number. Like, I love that whole thing. But that final scene is just so perfect. And I love that it just ends on Pam Grier's face, because I feel like that's what Quentin Tarantino just wants to look at, as Pam Grier's face. And I was like,
who doesn't?
Yeah, who doesn't? It's just, it, oh my God. I just think for a movie that goes on as long as this does, the fact that I want to just keep seeing these characters together, is, to me, this is such a compliment. And I can see how that at 27 or 26, I just did not appreciate
it. You get older every time you
Yeah, exactly. Well, whatever the hell I was.
At 32.
At 32. No. When I was in my 20s, let's say, when I saw this movie, I just didn't have an appreciation for that. I wanted another Pulp Fiction, of course, as did most people. And I wasn't mature enough at that age to be like, no, he's going to go do something. And he kind of has gone back to that. He's kind of, I think all of his movies after Jackie Brown have been more of the Pulp Fiction vein, which is kind of just these sort of genre exercises. And I think they're great and they're fun, but they're a little more, I think they're a little shallower than Jackie Brown. It's almost like he wanted to prove that he could do this. You know, like, hey, I can make a movie that has more mature themes on its mind. I'm going to go back to making movies about where they shoot Nazis. But I can make this, and I'm going to make it. I'm going to show you I can do it, just to show you I can do it.
But that's the Leonard influence, I think. That's Elmore Leonard. So. I mean, okay. It's 80% of the story is there from the novel.
Right, but Tarantino chose to make it, though.
You know, I understand that, yeah. But I'm saying, like, all these characters and all these layers that I think it's easy to assign it all to Tarantino.
Sure.
When maybe because I'm more of a Leonard fan than a Tarantino fan, but it's all, like, all this shit is always in Leonard's books. It's always there. Yeah, it's omnipresent.
Okay.
But I like the ending too, and I think it's a lot of his books end that, you know, end with they're always a lot of his books end in a bittersweet fashion. So.
Oh, I said I do want to read Rum Punch, and I will report back.
I like it.
I will report back, because I love these characters so much that I do kind of want to see I do want to see their extended adventures, even if it's in another form. Because I said this movie takes its time to do the heist and the prep for the heist. You know, like, we even have a time to like do a preparation scene, which is amazing. I mean, said it really is just everybody's at the top of their game. Keaton is fun. I love him in his leather jacket. I love when he's sitting there in the chair and he's like making, and you hear the little squeak of the leather. I love all those little details. Everybody here is just.
People want to do the movie. Did you read that?
What'd you say?
Like, he kept trying to get out of the movie.
Yeah, I heard that. Yes. He's like, oh, I'm not right for it. I'm not right. It's just ridiculous. Michael Keaton is right for
it. Who played Batman? The role you were probably least right for, and you made it. Amazing.
Yeah. You know, I don't know anybody who doesn't like Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton is like the Muppets. You know, it's like, I don't know anybody who doesn't like the Muppets. You know what I mean? It's like, if you're aware of the Muppets, you like them. Michael Keaton is like that. Is there anybody that's like, oh God, Michael Keaton in a movie? Pass. Who says that? You know what I mean? Everybody's so happy to have him back. So yeah, I love him in this. I think he's just terrific. I love the whole conversation he has with Jackie about stealing the money. Where she kind of like hints a little that maybe she's thinking of stealing the money. And he's like, well, yeah, we could steal the money, but you know, who doesn't agree that it, you know, he's like, but that would be stealing. You know, who doesn't agree? The Bureau of Alcohol, you know, Tobacco and Firearms, ATF. The ATF, you know, I mean, he's ramrod straight. He doesn't want her to, and the conversation they have after she pulls off the heist where her lies all line up just right. And you could see the Keaton's character doesn't buy it. But he doesn't have any proof, so he just has to go along with it. And I love all that. It's everybody here. Said Jackson, De Niro, Fonda, Keaton, you know, even Tiny Lister and Chris Tucker. You mentioned Chris Tucker,
Denise
Michael
Crosby.
Bowen, Denise Crosby, Sid Haig is there, and especially Pam Grier and Robert Forster. I'm glad that it helped put both of them back on the map a little more. Yeah. More Forster than Grier. But it definitely helped put them back on the map, because I said this is just such a big Valentine to these two, and they are just they're just great in it. I love this movie. I genuinely think it's a masterpiece. I think it's like a nearly flawless movie. It is in my top 10 of all time. I would see it again in the theater if they played it. I just absolutely love it. And when you and I were talking about what movie we wanted to discuss, you know, we went back and forth a bunch of things. And the minute you said Jackie Brown, I was like, yep, that's it, Jackie Brown. And I watched it again. Not that I needed to, but I watched it again just
before we
recorded, just for fun, because I was like, "This is just so pleasurable to watch." So,
I can't take a multi-floor escalator without singing Across 110th Street now.
Great song, really, man.
Oh. Real fast. Just I want to go with the expanded universe thing real fast.
Okay.
So Life of Crime was a movie that's based on The Switch, which is about the early days of Ordell, Melanie, and Lewis. And Ordell is played by Mos Def. Melanie's played by Isla Fisher. And all
right.
You're Isla Fisher. The ugly one in the movie with Gal Gadot.
Yeah, yeah. That's I love that. That's Hollywood, man. When Isla Fisher can be the plain one in a movie. Isla? That's amazing.
And Lewis is played by John Hawks, who plays Saul in Deadwood, which is with Timothy Oliphant, who then plays Raylan Givens, a Elmore Leonard character in Justified. So it all kind of...
Okay.
But yeah, then Ray Nicolette, of course, again in Out of Sight. With that actually features Samuel Jackson as well.
Oh, that's right. And he's got a cameo in that movie. Not playing Ordell, of course, because
Ordell
doesn't make it out of this movie. But yeah, that was a nice little cameo. Yeah, we'll have to cover that. That's a great movie, too. That's a really great movie.
Oh, that's my favorite. That's my favorite Elmore Leonard adaptation.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll get to that. That's a
soundtrack?
Terrific movie.
Did you love the soundtrack?
What, the soundtrack to Jackie Brown?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. I love it. I love all the Delphonic stuff. And Across 110th Street is like one of the great songs ever recorded. And so, yeah, no, Tarantino's movies always have great soundtracks, obviously. But no, I love the music. And all the instrumental stuff is fantastic. I love it.
And Pam Grier sings on it. Longtime woman.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. We love Pam Grier.
Yeah.
Who doesn't?
I was waiting for you to get to that point, but I guess.
Okay. Well,
awesome.
All right. Yeah, Pam. Everybody loves Pam Grier. Awesome. She just needs to be in more movies. She's on Twitter. Everybody, you can follow her on Twitter. So, she follows the show on Twitter. She follows Swim and Water Podcast on Twitter. I'm very excited.
You need
about
to
that.
Get her on, Rob.
I've tried. I mean, come on, it's Pam Grier. I'm sure she has a lot on her plate. So, you know, you want to talk?
Well,
to
she's very political right now.
Yes. Good for her.
So,
I'm sure she don't want to talk to some nerd about movies and stuff. So, but anyway. well, David, thank you for coming on as always. Always enjoy talking to you. Where can people find your stuff on the internet?
I haven't had anything.
All right. We go through this every time. We'll just point people to your Twitter feed. How about that?
Yeah, I got nothing going on right now. I just did that article for Emmys on the character of Deke for Inhumans. Not Inhumans, I'm sorry. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Okay. I was like, wow, Inhumans.
Sorry. I knew it was a Marvel show, and I temporarily blanked. And I should say I just spent a good amount of the weekend with your co-host, Shag Matthews.
I'm sorry.
You come up a lot. You're a hero to many. By the way, more praise for our video store episode that I heard for people that have heard the show.
Oh, that's nice. That was a good one.
Really liked that one.
Yeah, it was fun.
I don't know why in particular, because, I mean, you know what I mean. I guess I thought it might be too inside baseball or something.
I think much like Grier and Forster, you and I have chemistry, David, and that's just the way it is.
We might have to talk about what you mean by that later.
is your ass bigger, David? Nothing wrong
it
with
is,
that.
It is, actually.
Nothing wrong with that.
Photographic proof.
Anyway, all right, everybody. Yeah. Thanks for listening. If you haven't seen Jackie Brown, go to Netflix. You can watch it. It's just terrific. It's just such a great movie. So you can...
Best.
What?
Tarantino's best.
Tarantino's best. Absolutely Tarantino's best. And I love Pulp Fiction, but I will say without a doubt, Jackie Brown is Tarantino's best. So, of course, you can follow the show over on Twitter, @FilmAndWaterPod, and all our episodes are on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. So we will see you later, and until then, that's a wrap.
Brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, yet nothing didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester.
across 110th Street. Pimps trying to catch a woman.